So yeah, oh man, got a bit of an upset stomach today. That's why I've got like herbal tea going on.
All right. So, okay.
Yeah. Well, I was out on. I think this is the sign of the time. So I was out on Friday evening. It was kind of first proper kind of like night out at a pub with a friend, and we met up. It's just the two of us. We met up in this pub in nearby local town. Really nicely organised. I mean, one-way system. Every other table empty. Hand sanitizer. You can only order through an app. You can't go to the bar. So it was quite. It felt pretty secure. But I don't think I'm used to kind of, you know, after all this time, I'm not used to throwing down the pints, perhaps, in the same way. I think it's upset my stomach. I mean, it might not be. You'd be interested.
Since Friday.
It was on Friday. Yeah, you'd be interested actually, because it got to about 4 pints down. My friend, who shall remain nameless, her name is actually Catherine, and she's a librarian. Said, so this Wittgenstein, what's he all about then? And I thought,
oh, really?
four and a half pints down. He's like, I don't want to be explaining Wittgenstein, for pity's sake. Why would you do this to me?
Some would say you have to have 4 points to be able to start to talk about Wittgenstein.
That's quite, that's a possibility, isn't it? Yeah, maybe.
No, I know you mean. You really have to be sharp, don't you? It's like, I remember when we actually had a few podcasts on Wittgenstein, I knew I have to go back to the books. You can't just, you can say little bits, but if you really want to go into it, you've got to.
Exactly. Paddle in the shallows is fine, yeah, but if somebody genuinely wants to say, okay, so, you know, explain Wittgenstein to me, I'm thinking, I don't know. I mean, you wrote two philosophies that were different to each other. I mean, you know. So you really don't want to know. No, I really want to know. No, you don't. Yeah, I do. So next time I meet up with her, I'm going to ask her to explain either the Dewey Decimal System to me, and so how do you like it?
after a few pints.
Yeah. There's a systematic review. Explain this to me. So how you doing, Danny? You good?
Not bad, I guess. Just a general feeling of the world just looks increasingly bad and a negative. It's hard. I'm quite an optimistic person. It's quite hard to fight against it some days.
It's true.
That's what I'm, yeah.
I had a week off this week.
Good.
Well, you say good. I mean, actually, I think it's made me feel a little bit kind of bleaker than not, because, you know, you have a week off and you think, well, I'm still sat, apart from the Friday night, I'm still sat at home. And I still have a tendency, well, if I'm sat here, I will check my email. Oh, yes, you know, my boss has talked about this. I might as well respond to that. And then you respond to it. And then she says, well, can you join me for a meeting, you know, as you're around? So why not? What else am I doing? You know, so it was sort of a holiday, but, it's like, you know, being locked up. And, you know, if you were locked up in solitary confinement and somebody said to you, yeah, but you got a week off now, you're still in solitary confinement, you know. So I kind of frittered it away.
I know what you mean. When I had the week off, I was looking forward to it so long. And I had a week off, and a few days were great. And then I wanted to make sure I used every single moment of my time. But you end up going around in circles.
Yeah.
I'll start this, and I'll start that, and I'll start that.
Yes. And then I find myself lying in bed thinking, okay, I'm going to crash out. I'm not going to get up early. I'm going to lie in bed. But you're thinking, but the more I'm lying in bed, the more I'm taking away from time I could be doing other things. So what's the optimum amount of time I can lie in bed to enjoy it without feeling I've wasted, you know, the best part of the day? And then I finally decided that, you know, the two things I was doing was really kind of, you know, lying in bed and playing computer games. So ultimately, being unconscious and being in a virtual world were the only two things that actually gave my vacation meaning. So it was kind of okay. As long as I'm unconscious, that's pretty good. You know, it's quite kind of a level.
I find that I used to love the game Civilization.
Yeah,
you're aware of that one. That's my all-time favorite time killer.
Absolute classic.
And I think it's comedian Richard Herring said when he's in the old folks' home, he's going to have like a laptop playing Civilization 2. And that's like perfect, yeah. I can imagine that. And I was playing an updated version of it. My son got it off his Civilization 5 or 6 or something like that. and it's not the same, but it was good. And I got the same old feeling, but earlier on. So the same old feeling was I'd play it, enjoy it, love it, and then like an hour or two in, I'm like thinking, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah, it's just like an hour or two after I've got up. It's just kind of, what the hell?
That old feeling like when I was early 20s or even teenager, I can't remember when it was out first, but you would forget everything. And what's that strange feeling? Oh, yeah, I haven't eaten yet. That's the kind of game you're just completely into and you don't have.
Absolutely, yeah. That kind of keys into the whole like, Protestant work ethic. Because it's that idea that, unless you're doing something productive, then you're wasting your time. I don't buy into that, that idea that, there are things you can do with your time which don't necessarily have to be utilitarian, they don't have to plug into a particular kind of functional agenda for them to be valuable things to be doing. But I made the mistake.
It's like a byproduct of religion that I'm feeling that way.
I think so. Supposed to be kind of serving the greater good. And doing the Lord's work and not kind of just messing around online. But I made the mistake of revisiting The Last of Us on PlayStation.
I've never played it, but I've heard of it.
It's basically just kind of, where we are now, but just more so. It's kind of, it's just really, really quite depressing kind of post-apocalyptic world where you're trying to kind of get some kid out of that who's like immune to whatever disease it is that's wiped everybody out, turned everybody into zombies, and you're trying to get her out of town. And everybody you know and love just dies left and right. And you're thinking, oh God, why am I playing this? It was a good game, but oh, really? Perhaps less grueling games I could be playing. I'm also playing Animal Crossing on the Switch, which is an entirely it's the entire obverse of that. It's all sweet and innocent and cute. To be honest, I'll be sat there in team meetings, nodding away, saying yeah, it's really interesting, and I'll have Animal Crossing kind of open on my lap, but people can't see it, on screen. And I'm collecting fruit and I'm building, building your ideal world, and it's just cute and it's lovely and nobody's awful to each other and the economy's based on barter. It's lovely, So anyway, so that's what I've been doing myself.
It's a mad game because it's real time.
Yeah, it is. Isn't it? It's a weird community.
Lily was playing it and she said, I've got a new house.
Mm.
But I have to wait till tomorrow. And she thought that it was going to be like Minecraft.
Yeah, no, deferred gratification, man. You've got to wait.
No, you have to actually wait till tomorrow.
Yeah. And it's this guy who runs the whole kind of outfit. This guy called Tom Nook.
Yeah, he's some sort the of CEO.
Like, he must be minted. And every time you go to him and just say, hey, yeah, I'd like to live on your island. He says, yeah, come and live on the island. We'll make some space for you. We'll do this, we'll do that. And then as soon as you settle, then he starts hitting you up for money. And then it's kind of, oh great, well done, you've paid up for your room you bought now, your little house with one room, that's great. Oh, would you like an extension? We could add an extension, make it nice for you, and you could do some extra stuff in it. Yeah, that's a great idea. That will cost you another 200,000 bells or whatever. And before you know it, you are knee deep into this guy for money. Everything. So there's this undercurrent of hardcore capitalism built into this really cute game. We had all our film, we did all our film review things, mm-hmm. and thanks to our regular listeners who stuck with us and found benefit in you and I blathering on. Some people actually quite enjoyed the films.
Yeah.
Some people have actually said they're going to go and find the films and watch them themselves because they've not come across them before. So that's quite
brilliant.
Nice. I like that. Although we used it as a kind of a way of just leveling out a bit after the whole kind of history of philosophy that we tried to cover. I think we both genuinely felt that it was some really useful hardcore philosophy buried in.
It's kind of a mix between. Finding the most philosophical films and a bit of self-indulgence.
I think it's 80% self-indulgence, 20% philosophy. So as a reward for our listeners, we decided that we're going to explore the possibility of philosophical cage fighting, where we're going to discuss an issue perhaps and just bring in a couple of philosophers who may have a different perspective on the issue, and just see how that goes. It's sort of a sort of a Thunderdome, really. You know, two philosophers enter, one philosopher leaves, or they come to some sort of amicable arrangement. You know, I mean, with Wittgenstein, you could actually have, you know, two Wittgensteins enter and one Wittgenstein leaves, couldn't you?
Well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Just have, like, you know, early and later Wittgenstein slugging it out over an issue. You could do that on your own, and I wouldn't even need to turn up.
We'll have to see about that.
Yeah. So, not that we're necessarily going to have to. Either one of us is going to necessarily advocate for one side over another. We're going to role play this. I mean, although you're dressed up for, you know, in the gear, you know, you've got, like, the Jeremy Bentham outfit on at the moment. Loving the hat.
That's it.
That is a nice hat. We're not necessarily going to role play that, but I think we've decided that we're going to look at ethical issues from the point of view of a deontological ethicist, which is somebody like Kant, who has a really kind of absolutist perspective on these things, and then a teleological ethicist who has a kind of an end result situationalist approach to ethics. Is that what we decided? I think we decided.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, you happy with that?
I'm happy with that. I've since found that you could argue that utilitarianism can be, in a sense, deontological. But that's for
interesting. Well, we can strut that one at some point. Mm-mm. Yeah.
But so yeah, it's consequentialism, I guess. Really, is we're talking about.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, so I mean, just to get get the ball rolling. I mean, it's throughout all of our philosophical discussions, there tends to be a sort of and I'm simplifying here, broadly two camps that tend to emerge. There's the kind of the philosophers and thinkers who kind of like things to make an absolute sense. There are the philosophers and thinkers who like a kind of a grand narrative, or they like to be able to kind of pin things down so that you can speak with certainty about stuff. And we plotted this, didn't we? I mean, kind of through the kind of history of that. You have kind of religious ideologies, particularly, I think, kind of Christianity, for example, and so on, providing an absolute metaphysic. You know, there is a law to the universe. It's all kind of laid down in the mind of God. And there is a right and a wrong way. There's almost like a manufacturer's instruction manual for how things ought to run. And we can genuinely kind of sit down and say, well, if you do this, you know, if you pour milk or sugar into the petrol tank, you're going to expect it to go wrong. So don't do that. This is what you put here. This is what you put there. And if you follow the maker's instructions, everything will work as it should be. And Plato very much has the same view. This kind of absolute view that there are the ideal forms which help to kind of govern our understanding of the world. And the more we approximate to the ideal forms, then the more we understand what is absolutely true, absolutely beautiful, and so on. So you got that.
Well, it's kind of an assumption, isn't it? Like, I think that's maybe underlying all at the most fundamental level. The assumption is things are a bit chaotic. Mm. Obviously, life is a bit difficult and chaotic. Let's try and sort it out a bit.
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's it. Yeah. And you get. I mean, and I think that comes to a peak, doesn't it? When you get to kind of the Enlightenment, you're kind of moving into. In a sense, when you get to kind of the 15th, 16th century, and you start to have the kind of the more religious wars kicking off, where you know you get kind of Reformation and so on, people started to question the authority, the universal authority of Catholicism and so on. As soon as you get that, you're starting to say there are a variety of ways of even interpreting the religious traditions, and that's when the cracks and the absolute start to. Because when you've got like one voice, you know, the Pope, you know, the Bishop of Rome, so saying, okay, we are speaking for God. Not only have you got an absolute metaphysic, which is supposed to define the way things are, but you've got an absolute conduit to that So, you know, you've got the church saying, yeah, we will now pass that information down, and it is inviolable. I mean, it's, you know, the Pope can speak with the voice of God, and we can pass that down. When you start having religion starting to fragment into the kind of the Protestant churches and so on, as well, then you've got this kind of, oh, well, we haven't even got that kind of pure conduit anymore. There are a multiplicity of different ways of interpreting the absolute text, and maybe we'll never know, even if there is a God with an absolute plan. The conduit's broken. We may never know what that absolute plan is. We don't have that pure connection, or the confidence of pure connection anymore. So, you know, that starts to undermine that conviction. And then you have the Enlightenment kind of coming along and sort of saying, well, you know, increasingly, actually, we don't need this. It's just as, you know, religion is just as chaotic as anything else. What we need is another kind of absolute. And so we can, you know, Descartes talk about reason. And the absoluteness of kind of, you know, of rational consciousness, and the kind of scientific, you know, the glorification of science, and the objectivity of science, and that's when we start saying, well, okay, can we develop a whole? Can we develop ethical systems as well, which provide us with that absolutism? So, in the Enlightenment is an attempt to say we still need that metaphysic, that absolute. So you've got kind of Marx, even in kind of politically having an absolutist kind of model. You know, you've got people like Kant, who still has kind of a residual kind of religiosity, saying, okay, we need to kind of identify where absolute ethics come from. So there's that kind of, almost that kind of terror that if we abandon the absoluteness of religion, where's our guidebook? You know, if you throw away the manual, and this is, I mean, I bought myself. You'd be pleased with this. I'll show you a picture of this, actually, because, I mean, our viewer can't see it. But, I mean, I think you'll approve of this. Seeing as I haven't gone anywhere this summer, this is my gift to myself for...
Okay, so I'll try to explain what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
So it's obviously some kind of drink. It looks like a kind of futuristic beer pool.
Yeah.
It looks like something from 2001.
Yeah, it's very slick. It's very lots of silver and black. Yeah, it's a home beer pump, and you buy these kegs and you slot them in, and it chills the beer, and you can basically, you know, create your own pub in the house, so you never have to leave the house again.
You've reached it to the highest stage of humanity, isn't it?
It's essentially, if you look at it, it's almost the black monolith from 2001. It's just there challenging me. So you can't have another beer. It'd be great. Anyway, if you don't listen to it, you know, I'd just be sat there kind of like, you know, banging bones and you know, throwing.
You have to post that on the Facebook
site. I will post it on Facebook so people can see it. One of our listeners, who is an ex-student of mine, hooked me up with this because he'd recently bought one. So it's something that's kind of, you know,
perhaps the manufacturers will see it and then they'll send me a free one.
Maybe we could say, yeah, this is, you know, we could do a little product placement here.
Not that I do anything for, you know.
But I mean, the point of that is not just to strut my stuff. But, hey, look at this. I've got like a, you know, like a beer machine at home. It's not a magic beer machine. I mean, it doesn't just keep feeding you beer. You do have to kind of buy kegs to install in it. So it's not as, you know, it's not a panacea. But a big book of instructions came along. Okay, and I sod that, because nobody looks at the big book of instructions. In fact, in a lot of kit, doesn't even bother coming with instructions anymore. You kind of buy a phone.
That new phones don't come. Yeah,
no, absolutely, no, because I know people don't bother. But I mean, the idea of having the book of instructions, you know, the Bible or some kind of sacred text or some kind of, you know, classical text, this was a really important thing. And you know, you come to the Enlightenment, it's kind of, we haven't got these. We haven't got our manuals anymore about how to behave and who's good and who's bad and what's right and what's wrong and who's true and who's false. So we're going to have to kind of come up with this. And this is where, and I think this is where things get interesting. And this is where, you know, the likes of Nietzsche come along and say, you know, actually we just need to be brave, and we need to throw away the manuals, and we need to perhaps start talking about, you know, something other than a grand narrative manual explaining how everything works. But maybe we should just, you know, we should just be looking at the post-it notes that each one of us leaves lying around. Don't forget for the next generation.